principles to its readers, as we see Mark does in Mark 7, verses 3 to 4. Papias then says Matthew was composed in Hebrew and then translated various times into Greek, but that also can't be true, because Matthew copies extensively from Mark's Greek, frequently verbatim, and thus can't possibly have composed in Hebrew. And if Matthew employed a Q source for the remaining material shared with Luke, he also copied that verbatim in Greek, because Luke then also copied from Q and often shows identical wording, so Q itself or the version they employed must have been in Greek. It's clear that Papias had no idea what he was talking about and had no reliable sources of information about the first century of Christianity. Correct information about that century of the church had evidently become completely lost by his time. It therefore can't likely have survived after his time either, which means everything claimed about that period after this point is most likely fabricated. It is also curious that these five volumes of Papias were not preserved by medieval Christians. Such an early and extensive collection of contemporary lore about Jesus and the Gospels and Apostles as this should have been cherished. What else must it have said to so offend medieval Christians that they threw the whole thing away? We'll never really know. What we can say is that, from what we do know, nothing in Papias supports the historicity of Jesus. It confirms only that in the second century, many Christians were assuming the historicity of Jesus and were relying on written gospels for that and felt at liberty to invent any stories about him that suited them, while some were even claiming to have known someone who knew Jesus to lend authority to whatever they invented about him. That these claims were false should be obvious, because we just saw the stories they were telling were unbelievable. In the same fashion, some were also claiming to have known those who had been the very people resurrected by Jesus, just as some Jews claim to be descendants of those resurrected in Ezekiel 37, verses 1 to 14, even while other, more reasonable Jews insisted that that story was just an allegory and never really happened. Philip of Sidae reports that Papias had said, quote, "those resurrected by Christ from the dead lived until Hadrian," end quote, which was also claimed by Quadratus, so possibly Philip has confused them. Such wild legends are fully expected on the Jesus myth theory, and perhaps no less expected on historicity, so Papias has no effect on the consequent probability of either. Section 8. Hegesippus. Near the end of the 2nd century, around 180 AD, the Christian scholar Hegesippus wrote a 5-volume memoirs that discussed various legends about the early churches and apostles, including the first succession lists of bishops, making this the third closest thing to a history of Christianity that existed up to then, the second being the explanations of Papias, which I just discussed earlier, and the first being the book of Acts, which we shall discuss in the next chapter. Hegesippus may well have been alive in 130 AD when Hadrian deified Antoninus, but he wrote after 174, that being the year of the last datable event mentioned in the memoirs of Hegesippus. Once again, we do not have this book. We only have scattered references to and quotations from it. Again, why was such a valuable work not preserved? We may never know. This work is so very late and written in a period of such rampant fabrication and hearsay, as we noted in Element 44, that it cannot have any claim to reliability on the matter of first century Christianity. Nevertheless, I discuss it because, first, it is the last known attempt at collecting historical data about first century Christianity that we know of from the second century. And second, it discusses the fate of James the brother of Jesus. And third, it is representative of all the Christian historical literature we have any fragment of from the second century, and thus our conclusions regarding it can be understood as applicable to all. The most important passages to survive from Hegesippus involve tales about the family of Jesus, but they are so obviously fictional we can place no value in them as history. Of these, the following story about James is the most extensive we have, and it reads just like any of several examples of fabricated acts, such as we have telling wild tales about Peter and John. As Eusebius records, quote, "Hegesippus, who lived immediately after the apostles, gives the most accurate account in the 5th book of his memoirs. He writes as follows. James, the brother of the Lord, succeeded to the government of the church in conjunction with the apostles. He has been called the just by all from the time of our Savior to the present day, for there were many that bore the name of James. He was holy from his mother's womb, and he drank no wine nor strong drink, nor did he eat flesh. No razor came upon his head, he did not anoint himself with oil, and he did not use the bath. He alone was permitted to enter into the holy place, for he wore not woolen but linen garments. And he was in the habit of entering alone into the temple, and was frequently found upon his knees begging forgiveness for the people, so that his knees became hard like those of a camel, in consequence of his constantly bending them in his worship of God, and asking forgiveness for the people. Because of his exceedingly great justice, he was called the Just, and Oblios, which signifies in Greek, bulwark of the people, and Justice, in accordance with what the prophets declare concerning him. Now some persons belonging to the seven Jewish sects existing among the people, which have been before described by me in these memoirs, asked James, "What is the door of Jesus?" And he replied that he was the Savior. In consequence of this answer, some believed that Jesus is the Christ. But the sects before mentioned did not believe, either in a resurrection or in the coming of one to requite every man according to his works. But those who did believe, believed because of James. So when many even of the ruling class believed, there was a commotion among the Jews and scribes and Pharisees who said, "A little more, and we shall have all the people looking for Jesus as the Christ." They came therefore in a body to James and said, "We entreat you, restrain the people, for they are gone astray in their opinions about Jesus as if he were the Christ. We entreat you to persuade all who have come here for the day of the Passover concerning Jesus. For we all listen to you, since we, as well as all the people, bear you testimony that you are just and show partiality to none. Therefore, persuade the people not to entertain erroneous opinions concerning Jesus, for all the people, and we also, listen to you. Take your stand, then, upon the summit of the temple, that from that elevated spot you may be clearly seen, and your words may be plainly audible to all the people. For, in order to attend the Passover, all the tribes have congregated here, and some of the Gentiles also." The aforesaid scribes and Pharisees accordingly set James on the summit of the temple and cried aloud to him and said, "O Just One, whom we are all bound to obey, for as much as the people are in error and follow Jesus the Crucified, do tell us what is the door of Jesus the Crucified." And he answered with a loud voice, "Why ask me concerning Jesus the Son of Man? He himself sits in heaven at the right hand of the great power and shall come on clouds of heaven," end quote. And when many were fully convinced by these words and offered praise for the testimony of James and said, "Hosanna to the Son of David," then again the Pharisees and scribes said to one another, "We have not done well in procuring this testimony to Jesus, but let us go up and throw him down, that they may be afraid and not believe him." And they cried aloud and said, Oh, the Just Man himself is in error." Thus they fulfilled the scripture written in Isaiah, "Let us away with the Just Man, because he is troublesome to us. Therefore shall they eat the fruit of their doings." So they went up and threw down the Just Man, and said to one another, "Let us stone James the Just." And they began to stone him, for he was not killed by the fall. But he turned and kneeled down and said, "I beseech thee, Lord God our Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And while they were thus stoning him to death, one of the priests, the sons of Rechab, the son of Rechabim, to whom testimony is borne by Jeremiah the prophet, began to cry aloud, saying, "Stop! What are you doing? The Just Man is praying for us." But one among them, one of the fullers, took the staff with which he was accustomed to wring out the garments he dyed, and hurled it at the head of the Just Man. And so he suffered martyrdom, and they buried him on the spot, and the pillar erected to his memory still remains close by the temple. This man was a true witness to both Jews and Greeks that Jesus is the Christ. And immediately Vespasian besieged them. End quote. The historical and narrative implausibilities in this tale are so numerous we can be certain the story is in every respect a fabrication. The description of James is transparently mythical. The notion that he alone was allowed into the temple's inner sanctum is obvious nonsense. That the Jewish authorities would have a Christian evangelist stand at the pinnacle of the temple to dissuade the crowds from adopting his teachings is obvious myth, and that James could survive a fall from there is impossible. In fact, the behavior of almost everyone in the whole narrative is not at all realistic, a major hallmark of fiction. The execution of James, as described, is in no way legal, and would thus have been murder under Jewish law, and a burial not only inside the city walls but beside the very temple itself is not only a guaranteed falsehood, It betrays the complete ignorance of the narrative's author of even the most basic facts of Jerusalem law and culture. In short, nothing in this story can possibly be true. But what is notable is that nowhere in the story itself is this James ever said to be the brother of Jesus. Hegesippus describes him as such when introducing the narrative, but the assumption that this story about a certain James the Just is a story about James the brother of Jesus appears to be an assumption introduced by Hegesippus. It is not supported by anything in the story. Indeed, this James is described as if he were a priest, doing service in the temple and even entering the Holy of Holies, not a carpenter or fisherman from distant Galilee. There is also no reference to a historical Jesus in this narrative. Jesus is called the Crucified, but Jesus was celestially crucified on minimal mythicism, so that does not distinguish this narrative as historicist. To the contrary, nowhere is any reference made to witnesses or reports of Jesus having performed deeds or delivering teachings while on earth, or having even been on earth. Instead, James speaks only of a Jesus in outer space, who would descend to earth in the future. And the story assumes that no one thought Jesus was the Christ until James, not Jesus nor anyone else, began preaching that he was. And this led to people looking for Jesus and following him. Obviously, that cannot mean following the living Jesus, who in this narrative was not then on earth, but the celestial Jesus declared by James. The controversy at the heart of this narrative also centers around the bizarre question, what is the door of Jesus? The answer to which was that he is the Savior, the name Jesus, of course, meaning Savior, implying that confessing Jesus is the Christ is the doorway to eternal life. The theological point may have had something to do with Jesus being the celestial high priest who controlled access to the doors of heaven, which even some pre-Christian Jews might already have believed, as I noted in Element 40. For example, Ignatius says Jesus, quote-unquote, is the door of the Father by which enter the holy and faithful into heaven, and that he had this power because he was given the secrets of God and controlled the Holy of Holies, which must mean that of the celestial temple, there being no other when Ignatius wrote. The material about James and Hegesippus confirms our conclusion from Papias, that true historical information about the early church no longer existed, and had been replaced with absurd fabrications like this, which were believed without any doubt or question by such authors as this. But this narrative also joins the early redaction of the Ascension of Isaiah and the star narrative of Ignatius in further support of the hypothesis that there had been a sect of Christians who did not believe in a Galilean Jesus, but only a cosmically crucified one, and that these Christians had their own tales and narratives, which other Christians could borrow and adapt to their own purposes. From such a sect, we can expect this tale to lack any reference to a historical Jesus, most especially any reference to this James being his brother, despite it going on a great deal about his qualifications as a witness in being superlatively pious and just, conspicuously omitting from that list of qualifications his family connection and eyewitness status. These appear to have been unknown to the story's original author. Such a complete absence of the historical Jesus in this James narrative could perhaps be explained away as just a happenstance omission, assuming that the author who made it all up just didn't think or see the need of including any such detail, or perhaps already having included it in sections not quoted by Hegesippus. But such an omission also fits minimal mythicism even more perfectly. Whereas the historicist's explanation requires positing something that is less than 100% certain to be the case, the mythicist's explanation does not require positing anything, beyond minimal mythicism itself and established background knowledge, including elements 21, 22, and 44. This means this narrative in Hegesippus supports mythicism over historicity, at least slightly. I will be as generous to historicity as I can and posit a 90% chance that a historicist author could compose the narrative as we have it, against a 100% chance that a mythicist would, originally, for a 9 to 10 odds, although I believe 4 in 5 is closer to the truth, meaning an 80% chance that a historicist author could compose the narrative like this. Hegesippus recorded at least one other apocryphal tale about the family of Jesus, which can confirm neither historicity nor myth, the story that the grandchildren of his brother Jude, whom only some said had been the brother of Jesus, were hauled into the court of Domitian in the 80s or 90s AD because Domitian was afraid of the second coming of Christ, historically a wholly implausible motive, and had commanded that all Davidic heirs be slain, even though the very notion that anyone thought there would be Davidic heirs to slay by then is not believable. Vespasian is supposed to have slain all the Davidic heirs already, which is almost as implausible. Eusebius also mentions the family of Jesus with details that might derive from Hegesippus, such as that the gospel figure of Clopas was the brother of the Joseph who was the father of Jesus. Nothing is said of how Hegesippus would have known this. Probably, it is just an interpretation of John 19, verse 25, which itself is probably fabricated. It's possible, as well, that the entire succession narrative Eusebius surveys came from Hegesippus. Indeed, much of it could be the latter's own invention, the same way rabbinical authors invented Haggadah for the various persons named in the Old Testament. Here, Hegesippus was composing Haggadah for the persons named in the Gospels. Now, this particular story involving Domitian contains a number of implausibilities and does not look like anything we would credit as true. It also looks like it wasn't originally a story about Christians, but Messianic Jews. In the core of the tale itself, no Jesus is ever mentioned, and the quote-unquote Judeans hauled into court are never said to be anything but Jews expecting a Messiah to come at the end of the world. This had apparently been converted into a story about Domitian persecuting and then ending the persecution of Christians. But from other sources, we know only of Domitian persecuting Jews, and only those in his own household. Whatever the case may be, Hegesippus tips his hand when we learn from Eusebius that he told all these narratives in order to quote-unquote prove that there had been no heresy before the reign of Trajan, because up until then, the family of Jesus and his disciples had everywhere ensured a faithful adherence to the virgin gospel, and only after they had passed away did false sects arise. Such a fantasy is not only certainly false, the epistles of Paul already attest to numerous schisms, including his own, and there had surely been countless further splits all throughout the first century, it is also an obvious motive for inventing tales of family and eyewitnesses to Jesus. And from the details we find in the stories he told, we can tell they are unbelievable. Nor is any source given for them. So no reliable support for historicity can be had here. The probability of there being such tales is the same on either theory. Section 9. Josephus and the Testimonia Flaviana. There are two passages in the Jewish Antiquities of Josephus, originally published shortly before 93 AD, that, in the present text we have, mention Jesus Christ as a historical person. However, both are almost certainly interpolations made by Christian scribes. In fact, Josephus never mentioned Jesus Christ or Christians. We can therefore exclude these passages from our evidence. This is a somewhat controversial conclusion, so I will summarize the very reasonable basis for it. The first passage in question is called the Testimonium Flavianum. It now reads as follows, quote, "And there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if we really must call him a man, for he was a doer of incredible deeds, a teacher of men who received the truth gladly, and he won over many Jews and also many of the Greeks. This man was the Christ. And when, on the accusation of the leading men among us, Pilate had condemned him to a cross, those who had first loved him did not cease to, for he appeared to them on the third day, alive again, the divine prophets having spoken these and countless other marvels about him, and even until now the tribe of Christians, so named from this man, has not failed." End quote. Of course, even at a glance, anyone can see this would be an absurd paragraph from the hand of a devout Jew and sophisticated author who otherwise writes far more elegant prose, and usually responsibly explains to his readers anything strange. This passage is self-evidently a fawning and gullible Christian fabrication, in fact demonstrably derived from the Emmaus narrative in the Gospel of Luke, inserted into the text at a point where it does not even make any narrative sense, apart from being in a survey of the crimes of Pontius Pilate that contributed in the long run to inciting the Jews to war. This paragraph is so heavily indebted to the Gospel of Luke, in fact, we can be certain that it is its source. G.J. Goldberg demonstrates 19 unique correspondences between Luke's Emmaus account and the Testimonium Flavianum, all 19 in exactly the same order, with some order and word variations only within each item. There are some narrative differences which are expected due to the contexts being different and as a result of common kinds of authorial embellishment, and there is a 20th correspondence out of order, identifying Jesus as the Christ, But otherwise, the coincidences here are very improbable on any other hypothesis than dependence. Goldberg also shows that the testimonium contains vocabulary and phrasing that is particularly Christian, indeed Lucan, and un-Josephan. He concludes that this means either a Christian wrote it, or Josephus slavishly copied a Christian source, and the latter is wholly implausible. Josephus would treat such a source more critically, creatively, and informedly. There is no plausible way that this narrative fits that context. The Christians are not being connected with the war in any such way, and the Jewish elite are not outraged by the execution of Jesus, but in fact endorse it. Historians have tried to rescue this passage by rewriting it, removing everything that Josephus would surely never say, and then claiming he surely said what's left and Christians just changed it up. But this is such an extraordinarily improbable thesis, it must be rejected outright. For example, Josephus must have mentioned Christ, because he presumes it when he explains the name Christian in the last line. But there is no plausible way Josephus would say this, or even he was believed to be the Christ, as some later quotations have it, without explaining to his intended Gentile readers what a Christ was, and what it meant for Jesus to have been one, and thus why Josephus is mentioning it, or how Jesus even came to acquire the moniker. So we can strike those two sentences. Josephus cannot have written them. He also would not have written such fawningly unintelligible things as, quote, if we really must call him a man, end quote, or, quote, doer of incredible deeds, end quote, or, quote, teacher of the truth, end quote, without explaining again to his Gentile readers what he meant, or giving examples as Josephus normally would. So those sentences must be struck. He cannot have written them. Nor would Josephus say things like, quote, unquote, he won over many Jews and Greeks, without explaining exactly to what he won them over, and thus what defined someone as a Christian, what doctrines they held. Josephus does this for every other sect he discusses, such as the Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, and, under the rubric of the fourth philosophy, the Zealots. So he certainly would do so here, the more so as his remarks would be unfathomable to most of his readers without that explanation. So we can strike that sentence. He cannot have written it. Nor would Josephus give his readers a mysteriously truncated summary of what can only mean the gospel story of leading men accusing Jesus and getting him executed, without explaining what any of that meant. What leading men? What accusations? Why? Why did Pilate accede to them? Was Jesus guilty? Why did Pilate conclude he was? Why didn't the Jews execute Jesus themselves? And if he was such a powerful, truth-telling, miracle-working wise man whom many loved, how did he end up being convicted of a capital crime? The failure to explain these things makes the paragraph intolerably maddening to any reader, and would have been likewise to Josephus. He could not possibly have written this, so that sentence must go. Likewise, why does Josephus mention Jesus appearing on the third day, which is a Christian creedal statement that Josephus would not possibly employ without explaining why or what he thought that meant? Did Jesus escape his crucifixion? Was he therefore a fugitive on the run? What happened to him after this? Or did he appear in a dream or as a phantom? Or was he resurrected from the dead, a concept Josephus explains several times elsewhere in this work, so surely he would make a point of it here if this is what he meant or thought his source meant. So he cannot have written this either. And surely it is absurd to think Josephus agreed, much less would just so casually say, that Jesus fulfilled biblical prophecy at all, much less in these specific details as well as quote-unquote countless others. As this passage says, so he certainly did not write that sentence either. That leaves us with only one sentence left over, quote, and there was about this time Jesus a wise man, end quote, after which no story follows. We can conclude Josephus didn't write this either. He discusses several men named Jesus throughout his works, so he would certainly either identify this one, as we'll see, for example, he identifies another Jesus as the son of Damnius, or explain why he is suddenly interrupting his narrative to talk about this one. Otherwise, this transition is simply too abrupt and bizarre for Josephus. All these improbable sentences stack up to an enormous improbability that Josephus wrote any of this. And that's just from examining its coherence alone. The paragraph is simply unsalvageable. Nor should anyone desire to salvage it. It is obviously much too brief and much too obviously a simplistic Christian production based on the Gospel of Luke. Moreover, no other author had ever heard of this passage until Eusebius in the 4th century. Not even Origen, who otherwise cites and quotes Josephus several times, so surely Origen would have mentioned this passage had it existed in his copy of the Antiquities. The probability of his silence is very low otherwise, and that probability reduces even further when we consider the silence of every other Christian and pagan author, even if, and even collectively, their silence is not as improbable as Origen's. Considering just Origen alone, there are several passages where it's almost certain he would have remarked upon this paragraph, even quoted it had he known of it. For example, in his treatise Against Celsus, Origen is tasked with proving there was any near contemporary attestation to the affairs of Jesus. Yet all he can present in said proof are passages in Josephus attesting John the Baptist and, supposedly, James, as we'll see shortly. Likewise, at many other turns in his contest with Celsus, Origen would surely have had irresistible use of the fact that this same Josephus attested to the ministry of Jesus, declared him wise, and thus did not think him a charlatan, as Celsus persistently argues. That he corroborated his resurrection on the third day, a fact Celsus insists only Christians affirm, and confirmed that he fulfilled prophecy, a major point Origen struggles to establish, and for which the agreement of a Jew would have been priceless. All attempts to explain away Origen's silence require adopting one or more ad hoc hypotheses for which there is no evidence, such as that Josephus had written something wildly different, which the Testimonium Flavianum then replaced. Or they are illogical. For instance, even if an original Testimonium Flavianum had treated Christians negatively, that would even more have demanded a response, not less so, as the last thing Origen could allow is Celsus or any other critic citing Josephus, the very source whose authority Origen praises, against him, without a preemptive apologetic. So the silence of Origen is simply very improbable unless there was no Testimonium Flavianum at all. The silence of all the rest of Christian and anti-Christian literature only adds to that improbability. And the obvious improbability of the content of every single sentence, as I just surveyed, adds even more. So we are already looking at an extremely low probability that this passage, or anything even remotely like it, existed in the original antiquities. And yet, there are two more reasons that are even more decisive, sinking this probability well toward impossibility. First, since the very next paragraph begins, quote, "about the same time also another terrible thing threw the Jews into disorder," end quote, Josephus clearly had just ended with the sedition resulting in a public massacre described in the passage before the Testimonium, leaving no logical place for the unrelated digression on Jesus and the Christians. The original text obviously went directly from the massacre to the following scandal, with no digression in between. And secondly, the fact that his very next story, also about a religious controversy involving Judaism and ISIS cult, is told at great and elaborate length, a narrative 8 times longer than the Testimonium Flavianum, and yet on a much more trivial affair. The latter demonstrates that Josephus would have written a great deal more about the Jesus affair if he had written anything about it at all, whereas a forger would have been limited by what may have then been the remaining space available on a standard scroll for volume 18, or by the space available in the margin, if that is where the passage began its life, hence explaining its bizarre brevity, in comparison with the preceding and following narratives, and in light of its astonishing content, which normally, as I've noted, would require several explanations and digressions which are curiously absent. I believe these two facts alone combine to argue conclusively that there cannot have been here any reference to Jesus in the original antiquities, even one differently worded than we now have. When combined with the preceding considerations, the overall probability of any other conclusion approaches zero. It is sometimes claimed that we have an Arabic version of this passage that comes from an earlier manuscript of Josephus than is quoted by Eusebius, and its content is closer to what a Jewish author might write, and therefore this confirms, quote-unquote, that Josephus wrote something close to the Testimonium Flavianum after all. However, it has since been proved that this Arabic quotation is of a Syriac quotation of a manuscript of Eusebius, and thus represents a text that does not precede Eusebius, but derives from him. Its content was simply altered in transmission to sound more plausibly Jewish. But it most definitely does not come from Josephus. There is therefore no basis whatever for believing any mention of Jesus Christ occurred at this point in the Jewish antiquities. The scholar who demonstrated this, Alice Wheely, has tried to argue that it nevertheless represents an original version of Eusebius's quote of the Testimonium Flavianum and thus, in turn, represents the actual wording of Josephus. For example, reading, quote-unquote, he was believed to be the Christ, rather than, quote-unquote, he was the Christ, thus sounding more like something a devout Jew might say, even though Josephus would then be compelled to explain what a Christ was, yet doesn't. However, Wheely's theory requires the extraordinarily improbable assumption that all subsequent manuscripts of the Antiquities were amended to agree with the corruption, to he was the Christ, because all extant manuscripts now so read, and likewise all manuscripts of Eusebius, in all the places where he repeats this quote, because he repeats it several times, not just once. That all extant manuscripts of the Antiquities would so perfectly agree with a later corruption that somehow simultaneously occurred in all the works and manuscripts of Eusebius, which corruption, by Wheely's argument, must have occurred after the 4th century, is simply too improbable to be plausible. More likely, some early copy of Eusebius's history alone was improved by a scribe thinking to restore a more plausible quotation from a Jew, thus producing, for example, he was believed to be the Christ. And it is quotations of this that we see in Wheely's cited examples, because it is inherently less likely that all manuscript traditions of all the works of Eusebius and all the manuscript traditions of Josephus were conspiratorially amended the same way than that only one manuscript tradition of a single work of Eusebius was amended the other way and thus, as one would then expect, only occasionally evidenced in quotation, which, as Wheely shows, is what we observe. Her argument for authenticity is therefore to be rejected. Add to that the fact that even the altered Testimonium Flavianum that Wheely defends is wholly implausible from Josephus, as I showed from my survey of its contents earlier, the total silence of all other authors before Eusebius, especially Origen, and the two facts of its position in the text, that it interrupts the text as we have it, and is far too short to be a plausible insertion from Josephus. And there is simply no credible case left to be made in defense of the Testimonium Flavianum whatever. It simply wasn't there, and we need to give up trying to rescue it. That leaves one other passage in Josephus where it is said, quote, the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, the name for whom was James, and some others, end quote, were tried and stoned by the high priest Annas for unspecified crimes and in defiance of proper criminal procedure. Obviously, if Jesus Christ had a brother, then Jesus Christ existed. So Josephus is here said to confirm the historicity of Jesus by knowing details about his family. However, I have elsewhere demonstrated that the phrase, who was called Christ, is an accidental interpolation and was never written by Josephus. It entered the manuscripts of Josephus sometime in the late 3rd century. We know this because Origen never quotes this passage, even where scholars claim he does. In fact, Origen shows no knowledge of this passage as we have it, or the story it relates, or where it was located in the works of Josephus. Whereas Eusebius is the first to actually quote the passage we have in the present text of Josephus. He is thus the first to have known of it. Where Origen is now claimed to be citing this passage, he can be shown to have confused a story written by the Christian hagiographer Hegesippus, whom we just examined, as being in Josephus, when it was not. At that time, the original text of Josephus probably read either the brother of Jesus, the name for whom was James and some others, or the brother of Jesus, the son of Damnius, the name for whom was James and some others. Either way, only later accidentally incorporating a Christian marginal or interlinear note by insertion or replacement to correct what a later copyist mistook as an error, thereby eclipsing the original meaning of the passage, which was that Annas was punished for the offense of extra-legally executing the brother of Jesus ben Damnius by being removed from office and replaced by that same Jesus ben Damnius, as the narrative goes on to relate. There are six arguments for this conclusion, which together establish such an extremely low probability that any Christ was originally mentioned here that we can dismiss this evidence as of no value to determining the historicity of Jesus. First, the phrase, who was called Christ, is exactly the kind of thing a scholar or scribe would add as an interlinear note here, to remind him and future readers that, or so the annotator believed, the Jesus here mentioned is Jesus Christ, as we would do today with an informative footnote or marginal note. Indeed, these kinds of marginal passage identifiers are common in extant manuscripts. For example, one manuscript of Tacitus has similar comments in the margins identifying the passage mentioning Christ there, for the benefit of Christian readers skimming the text for passages of interest. And in this case, the idiom and vocabulary of who was called Christ, is a well-established Christian idiom, derived from the Gospels, commonly used by Origen, yet wholly alien to Josephus, who never otherwise uses the word Christ. In fact, the complete phrase, Jesus who was called Christ, is, apart from a necessary change of case, identical to that of Matthew 1 verse 16, which happens to be a passage about Jesus' family, which is thus a phrase Josephus would not be as likely to use as a Christian annotator would. Though such a phrase would not be impossible for Josephus to construct on his own, such a coincidence is less probable than if it originated from a Christian hand. Second, the words and structure chosen here are indeed the ones that would commonly be used in an interlinear note, essentially just a participial clause. Remarkable brevity for something that would sooner otherwise spark a digression or cross-reference had Josephus actually written those words. Obviously, there would almost certainly be a reference to the Testimonium Flavianum if it existed, perhaps even identifying the book in which it appeared, so readers would know what scroll to pick up to find out or remind themselves who or what this Christ is and why he's being mentioned, or at the very least mentioning that he had previously discussed this person, especially since the reference is so obscure. The more so as the extant Testimonium Flavianum does not mention Jesus having a brother, nor explains why his brother would be a target of prosecution, much less defense by other leading Jews. Indeed, it mentions no persecution of Christians at all, but instead emphasizes their unimpeded thriving, quote-unquote, to this day. Thus, there would be much to explain here, even if the Testimonium Flavianum had existed. For example, in this very same narrative about James, Josephus refers back to his previous discussion of the Sadducees, when he mentions them, and explains why mentioning them is relevant to his present story. Yet surely Christ would rate at least the same treatment, being the more obscure, as Sadducees were already mentioned several times previously, even in the very same book. And an explanation or cross-reference to the Testimonium Flavianum would be even more natural. For example, the one called Christ whom I mentioned before. After all, for the Sadducees, he gave us both a reference and an explanation of relevance. Likewise, when he mentions Judas the Galilean in Antiquities 20, passage 102, we get an as I mentioned before, and an explanation besides. Or if there was no Testimonium Flavianum, and as we just saw, surely there wasn't, certainly we'd find here an explanation of why this Jesus was called Christ, what that word even meant, at the very least explaining its connection to Christians and James's being one, if that is even what is meant, since James is not said to be a Christian here, or in the Testimonium Flavianum. Thus, the text as we have it here requires an assumption only a Christian would make, further arguing against this being from the hand of Josephus. And why Josephus thought it important to mention either, since the passage as written leaves no stated reason for either Jesus or his moniker Christ even to be mentioned at all. And any inferences to such a reason would only occur to a Christian, not to Josephus or his intended readers, who would not know anything about the obscurities of Jewish laws or religion, which is why he always explains such things when they come up elsewhere. Indeed, Josephus otherwise never uses the word Christ. Even where it appears in the Testimonium Flavianum, it is widely regarded as an interpolation, even by scholars who accept the authenticity of the Testimonium Flavianum. And as I noted earlier, I find Wheely's attempt to defend it implausible. In short, such omissions here are far more probable if, quote-unquote, called Christ, is an accidental interpolation than if they are the words of Josephus. Third, the story as we have it makes no sense as being the execution of Christians. Not only because no such basis for the executions is mentioned, but also because many influential Jews are outraged by the execution of this James and his men and seek the punishment of Ananus, and the Jewish and Roman authorities fully concur and duly punish him, which makes little sense if he was executing members of the hated, if not actually illegal, sect of Christians. Indeed, writing for a Roman audience in the era of Domitian, Josephus would be describing an inexplicable course of events, where the execution of Christians was considered a legal matter of course, not an act warranting outrage and dismissal from office. In fact, we get no sense from the way the story is told that there was any popular animosity towards this James and his affiliates. To the contrary, all the animosity in the story is against their killers. Regardless of what Josephus himself may have thought about Christians, it's more likely he would feel a need to explain this strange course of events to his Roman audience than simply gloss over it. Whereas if this wasn't a passage about Christians, then its content is not improbable at all. Fourth, apart from the execution being a stoning, the most common form of execution employed by the Jews, and therefore not at all peculiar to or indicative of Christian victims, this story does not agree with any other account of the death of James, the brother of Christ. It therefore is not likely to actually be an account of the death of James, the brother of Christ. It certainly was not known to be such by any Christian who composed those later accounts of that legendary figure's death, as we noted when we examined Hegesippus. Fifth, the book of Acts shows no knowledge of this event, and it is nigh impossible for a Christian of the time to know less than Josephus about the fate of James, the brother of Jesus Christ, particularly a Christian claiming to have researched the history of his church, as Luke does in Luke 1, verses 1 to 4. In fact, Luke makes a point of always depicting the Romans protecting or rescuing Christians from the excesses of Jewish persecution or other dire fates, for example, Gallio in Acts 18, Lysias and Festus in Acts 23 and 24, Roman guards in Acts 16 and Acts 27, and of depicting some among the Jewish elite as being less negatively disposed towards Christians. Gamaliel, for example, in Acts 5, even Herod Agrippa in Acts 25 through 26. In its present form, Antiquities 20, 200 has all of this. Indeed, it hands Luke a rhetorical coup, Romans and Herod Agrippa himself punishing Jews for persecuting Christians. There is no possible way Luke would have passed up an opportunity to include this in his account. The only explanation for why he didn't that has any probability is that this event never happened. Yet it is wholly improbable that Josephus would fabricate it. In fact, as Luke appears to have used Josephus as a source, Luke could not have found any story about James, the brother of Christ, in Josephus. Therefore, it wasn't there. Sixth, and most conclusively, Origen has no knowledge of this passage, despite being intimately familiar with Josephus and citing him often. We can therefore be certain Origen's copy did not contain a reference to Christ, here or anywhere. This has been commonly denied, but in ignorance. Where scholars claim Origen is quoting this passage, he is demonstrably not. Meanwhile, all other arguments against an interpolation occurring here are only against deliberate interpolation. But that is not what happened. The interpolation of, quote-unquote, called Christ was more likely an accident. So we already have five arguments for and none against, with the great weight of improbability ruling this passage out of consideration. But this sixth argument settles it. All passages where it is claimed Origen is attesting to Josephus's mention of Christ as the brother of James actually paraphrase a completely different story found only in Hegesippus, a story that is a patent Christian hagiography and thus cannot have originated with Josephus. Origen was simply misattributing it to him. In each case, Origen quotes nothing from Josephus except the words, "the brother of Jesus who was called Christ." But that's just the combination of two phrases, "the brother of Jesus" and "who was called Christ." The former entirely common and thus not distinctive of Josephus or Christianity, and the latter the accidental interpolation that did not originate with Josephus, for all the reasons already surveyed, but is instead, as I already noted, a well-established Christian idiom commonly used by Origen. By contrast, Josephus never otherwise uses the word Christ, and if he ever did, he would have explained what it meant and why he was using it. That he didn't entails he didn't write those words here. That Origen kept claiming he was paraphrasing Josephus when instead he was actually paraphrasing Hegesippus was simply a product of an error of memory, which Origen is known for. In fact, Hegesippus and Josephus were known to be confused by others too, so it was evidently an easy mistake to make. A good example of Origen making errors of memory is very much like this one. He confused something he had read in the Protevangelion of James as having been in Josephus, and thus incorrectly cites Josephus as his source. The authors Josephus and Hegesippus were also confused in some later manuscripts. Thus, it is an established error other readers of the time made, and some scholars have already suspected that this is what happened here. In summary, there is no evidence Josephus ever mentioned Jesus Christ. There is therefore no evidence here to consider. Section 10, Pliny and Tacitus. We can see Josephus is awash. That leaves only two other authors who wrote before 120 AD that actually mention Jesus, or at least Christ, Pliny the Younger and Tacitus. These authors are particularly significant because they were not only contemporaries, but best friends, who frequently corresponded and exchanged information for writing their histories, and were governing adjacent provinces at the very time Pliny first discovered what Christians preached. Pliny tells us that he had no idea what Christians were or believed until he interrogated some of them and discovered it was some sort of base superstition involving the worship of a certain Christ, who was something like a god. But he gives no further details about him, not even the name Jesus, and says nothing pertinent to establishing historicity. Pliny's hesitant phrase, as if to a god, quasi-deo, could reflect his response to the exoteric myth, if his Christian informants were simply repeating the Gospels to him, in which Jesus is allegorically presented as a historical man, or the esoteric myth, Jesus then being confusingly explained to him as a celestial archangel or demigod whom they pray to, but not exactly equal to God. It could also be a textual corruption, as there is some external evidence that Pliny may have originally written Christo et Deo, to Christ and to God, or Christo ut Deo, to Christ as God. At best, we might assume these Christians repeated to Pliny material from the Gospels, at least some of those had been in circulation by then. But as such, this is not independent evidence, and it's therefore useless. Pliny's procedure involved no independent fact-checking, and from his behavior and attitude, we can conclude his effort would have been typical, and thus Tacitus is unlikely to have done any better. Pliny had been governor of Bithynia, now northern Turkey, for over a year already before even learning there were any Christians in his province, and before that, he held the post of consul, the highest possible office in the entire Roman Empire, short of actually being emperor. He had also been a lawyer in Roman courts for several decades, then served in Rome as praetor, the ancient equivalent of both chief of police and attorney general, and then served as one of Trajan's top legal advisors for several years before he was appointed to govern Bithynia. And yet, he tells us, he had never attended a trial of Christians and knew nothing of what they believed or what crimes they were guilty of. This confirms that his father, Pliny the Elder, never discussed Christians in his account of the Neronian fire, despite having been an eyewitness to those events and devoting an entire volume to that year, though his account is now lost. For if he had, his devoted admirer, nephew, and adopted son, Pliny the Younger, would surely have read it, and thus would not have known nothing about Christians, as he reports in his letter to Trajan. We can therefore assume Tacitus would have been no better or otherwise informed when he wrote that Nero scapegoated the Christians for burning down the heart of Rome in 64 AD. The present text of Tacitus reads, quote, "Nero found culprits and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on those hated for their abominations, whom the people called Christians. Christ, the author of this name, was executed by the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius, and the most mischievous superstition, checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the source of this evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous or shameful flow in from every part of the world and become popular. Accordingly, arrests were first made of those who confessed. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much for the crime of burning the city as because of the hatred of mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their death." Tacitus here describes their torments. "Hence, even for criminals who deserved the most extreme punishments, there arose a feeling of compassion, for it no longer appeared that they were being destroyed for the public good, but rather to glut the cruelty of one man." End quote. The key line here is, quote, "Christ, the author of this name, was executed by the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius," end quote. This is the first ever reference to a historical Jesus outside the New Testament, dating to around 116 AD, very near our cutoff date for usable evidence. Because in Tacitus, references are made to Trajan's annexation of Parthian territories in 116 AD, but not their loss a year or two later. If the passage is authentic. In Hitler Homer Bible Christ, I demonstrate, following the arguments of scholars before me who have argued the same, that this line is probably an interpolation, and that Tacitus in fact originally described not the Christians being scapegoated for the fire, but followers of the Jewish instigator Crestus, first suppressed under Claudius, as reported by Suetonius, as we'll see shortly. The line about Christ being executed by Pilate was added sometime after the mid-4th century. Before then, no one, Christian or non-Christian, ever heard of this persecution event under Nero, or of any reference to Christians in Tacitus. This event is not mentioned even when second century Christians told stories of Nero persecuting Christians. However, we need not rely on that conclusion for the present analysis, and to demonstrate that, I will simply assume for the sake of argument that this passage is entirely authentic as received. If we instead assume the passage has not been tampered with, then where would Tacitus have learned of this? Not likely from government records. His report contains no distinctive information that one would expect from such a source, and Tacitus would not have wasted countless hours of his life hunting through obscure archives just to verify a single embarrassing anecdote the Christians themselves were already admitting to. Moreover, it is very unlikely any such records would have survived in Rome for Tacitus to consult, the capital's libraries having burned to the ground at least twice in the interim, once under Nero and again under Titus. The fire of 64 AD is, of course, being recorded by Tacitus himself and Cassius Dio, also Pliny the Elder, who was living in Rome at the time. The fire of 80 AD is reported by Suetonius. Domitian was tasked with rebuilding the libraries. Officially published records that we know Tacitus relied upon, like the Acts of the Senate, would have survived in libraries elsewhere in the empire, but those would not mention an obscure execution in Judea. However, we must dismiss the argument that Tacitus can't have been citing government records because he gets the office of Pilate wrong, misidentifying him as a procurator when in fact he was a prefect. Because Pilate was both a procurator and a prefect, as most equestrian governors were, and Tacitus had particular rhetorical reasons to prefer mentioning the procuratorial office in a passage like this, because it was more embarrassing and more appalling to be executed by a mere business manager. See my discussion of this point in my book, Hitler, Homer, Bible, Christ, for more. It's also unlikely Tacitus learned of this from earlier historians of Nero, such as Pliny the Elder, as I've noted before, since had they written about Christians, we would probably know of this from their histories having been preserved precisely because they mentioned Christ, or quoted by Christians or their critics. Likewise, that Christians appear to have had no knowledge of the Neronian persecution, having any connection whatever with the burning of Rome, further entails no earlier historian is likely to have made such a connection either, as otherwise such pervasive ignorance even by the Christians themselves is nearly inexplicable. If Tacitus really made such a connection, he was apparently the first, and possibly by mistake, conflating some other persecution of Christians, or even a Christian legend about a persecution that never really happened, with the burning of Rome. For as we shall see, Suetonius had no knowledge of such a connection either. But we know Tacitus asked Pliny for information to include in his historical books. Thus, the fact that Pliny discovered what Christians preached in 110 AD, right when Tacitus was governing an adjoining province and writing his histories, and just a few years before Tacitus completed his annals before 117 AD, suggests the most likely chain of information was Christians telling Pliny about the Gospels, then Pliny telling Tacitus, and Tacitus then reporting what would be to him the most embarrassing details in his annals. That would explain why his information matches what was already reported in the Gospels by that time and gives no further detail. At the very least, this cannot be ruled out. Accordingly, we cannot verify that the information in Tacitus comes from any source independent of the Gospels, and non-independent evidence carries zero weight. So either Tacitus never mentioned Christ, or his mention of Christ cannot be shown to be independent testimony. Either way, his information has no effect on the probability of myth or historicity, and neither does the information recorded by Pliny. Indeed, even if we blow past all probability and imagine that somehow Tacitus is paraphrasing or adapting a story from an earlier historian of Nero, Christians could already have been preaching the exoteric myth, some form of proto-Mark, for example, in 64 AD as an allegory, an extended parable, whose real meaning, its esoteric meaning, that of a cosmic event, would be explained only to initiates, as we noted in Elements 13 and 14. Thus, even a mention of Christ being crucified by Pilate at that date, if such a detail was only learned from Christians, would not strongly confirm historicity. And even if Christians hadn't yet gelled this exoteric myth by then, their claims that Jesus was celestially crucified by the rulers of this world during the reign of Pilate could easily be misunderstood by a half-interested Roman audience as crucified by Pilate. Thus, even the cosmic crucifixion of minimal mythicism could so easily be misreported in a historicist fashion that our inability to rule that possibility out further complicates third-hand evidence such as this. And that only compounds the fact that, as I've shown, Tacitus almost certainly had no such Neronian-era source, was most likely just reporting information relayed to him from Pliny, who in turn learned it from second-century Christian informants, or taking his information directly from Christians himself, if he originally even mentioned Christians at all. This passage, therefore, has zero effect on the probability of either history or myth. Section 11. Suetonius and Thallus. Two other authors used as evidence for a historical Jesus provide no evidence for a historical Jesus. The first of these is Suetonius, the second, Thallus. As for Thallus, I have already demonstrated elsewhere that he never mentioned Jesus. The passage in the third book of the otherwise lost Histories of Thallus, which was referenced by Julius Africanus in another lost work, quoted by the medieval chronologer George Sincellus, almost certainly said nothing more than that for the year 32 AD, quote, the sun was eclipsed, Bithynia was struck by an earthquake, and in the city of Nicaea many buildings fell, end quote, with no mention even of Judea, much less Jesus. For we can reliably deduce that we have this direct quotation of Thallus in several surviving fragments of Eusebius, which means when Africanus connected this entry in Thallus to Jesus, he was making that assumption, not Thallus. This same evidence indicates that Thallus wrote after Phlegon, whose work is usually dated between 120 and 140 AD, as the line Eusebius apparently quoted from Thallus appears to be an abbreviation of Phlegon, whose entry on the same events Eusebius explicitly quotes, and it too makes no mention of Judea or Jesus, because Thallus gives the exact same information in the exact same order, only with much less detail. As for Suetonius, there are only two relevant passages. The first is a reference to Jewish rioters, not Christians. Suetonius says of the Emperor Claudius that, quote, since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he expelled them from Rome, end quote. We have reason to doubt Suetonius has his story straight, since such an expulsion of all Jews from Rome would have been a near impossibility. There would have been tens of thousands of Jews in Rome at that time, complete with extensive real estate, synagogues, businesses, as well as countless Jewish slaves in both private and public hands that would have been indispensable to the urban economy, not to mention an enormous challenge to locate and drive out. In fact, we learn from Cassius Dio that, quote, as for the Jews, who had again increased so greatly that by reason of their multitude it would have been hard without raising a tumult to bar them from the city, Claudius did not drive them out, but ordered them, while continuing their traditional mode of life, not to hold meetings, end quote. Which is a far more plausible report. The 5th century Orosius claims Josephus reported this expulsion, but there is no mention of this in Josephus's extant works. Orosius is probably confusing this with an expulsion incident under Tiberius, which is mentioned by Josephus. Orosius also reads Christus instead of Crestus in his quotation of Suetonius, and thus assumes he was speaking of Christianity. One might still ask why Josephus omits not only any mention of Claudius's edict against the Jews over the Crestus affair, or the riots that inspired it, but also any mention of the burning of Rome or of any Jewish faction, whether Christians or Christians, being involved in it, despite the fact that Josephus was in Rome at the time as a close acquaintance of Nero's wife. These omissions are probably deliberate. Josephus generally aimed to suppress any discussion of Jewish messianism, to downplay or diminish Jewish complicity in major incidents, and to paint Claudius as uniformly favorable to the Jews, so I think these events would have ruined his preferred storyline. It's still possible some select Jews were expelled, as Suetonius does not actually say all Jews were expelled, but only that Jews were. But a total expulsion cannot really be believed. Acts 18 is alone in saying all the Jews were expelled during this incident, but its reliability on this point is doubtful. Neither Suetonius nor Dio have any knowledge of this decree, or the riot inspiring it, being in any way connected to Christians. In fact, not even Acts shows any awareness of this expulsion being connected to Christians. Yet the author of Acts would certainly have made use of the fact that the Jews were making trouble for Christians in Rome and were duly punished for it by the emperor. So we can be fairly certain no such thing occurred, and thus no such rhetorical coup was available to the author of Acts. Suetonius clearly wrote that the riots were instigated by Crestus himself. Impulsore Cresto means because of the impulsor Crestus, an impulsor being the person who instigates something, not the reason for instigating it. And so it cannot plausibly be argued that this meant Jesus, who was neither alive nor in Rome at any time under Claudius. Acts 28, likewise depicts Jews at Rome knowing little about Christianity beyond distant rumors, which hardly makes sense if the whole Jewish population of Rome had rioted over it just a decade before. Paul's entire letter to the Romans likewise exhibits no knowledge of such a thing. Moreover, if the second passage in Suetonius has been soundly transmitted, as we'll note shortly, Suetonius knew the difference between Christians and Jews and would have commented on the fact had Christians, much less Christ, been in any way the cause of these riots. Many scholars nevertheless try to press this evidence in that direction, but it's simply not able to bear any weight. Even supposing Suetonius is wildly wrong about Jesus being in Rome under Claudius and starting a riot there, that would entail his information was so hopelessly confused he cannot be attested